Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Few jobs have changed as much in recent decades as purchasing manager. Change has been so great that even the name's changed. It's now supply chain manager. Sounds boring, but it's not. I wouldn't have had this do this topic here on the radio. And it is an under-the-radar field with a lot of job openings. Indeed.com, which is just a website that has lots of job listings, that website alone lists 610 openings for supply chain managers just in the Bay Area. What's it really like to be a supply chain manager? And why did I find the field interesting enough to devote a segment to it? With me to answer those questions is Celeste Ayers, supply chain manager at Parker Hannifin. It's a Fortune 250 company. It's a parts manufacturer. She's also director of performance improvement for APEX. That's the Professional Association for Supply Chain Management. And she has taught supply chain management at Modesto Junior College. And next semester, she goes back to Golden Gate to teach it there. Celeste Ayers, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So how is being a supply chain manager different from that predecessor job title? I should let our listeners know. This is a very family-friendly show here. And since they came all the way from Modesto, I encourage them to bring her husband and her two kids, Adam and Alex. Adam is like one or two? How old?
He's about one and a half.
One and a half. And Alex, you're...
Four and a
half. Okay, so we may get little interruptions, but hopefully not too distracting. You know, we're supposed to be family-friendly in this modern era. So there we go. All right, so now... Back to you, Celeste. Do you like to be called Sully or Celeste?
Celeste is the preferred.
Okay. So, how is being a supply chain manager different from its predecessor job title, which was buyer or purchasing manager?
Well, those jobs still exist, but what really has happened... So supply chain management is really nothing new. It's not a new concept whatsoever. It's been around since the dawn of time. But it became a new word in the late 90s when it was coined as a new discipline. But really what it is the focus of the information flow and product flow from the suppliers all the way through the customer and back and forth. And so purchasing is one aspect of that. And so now, like we said, purchasing is a discipline that is still required within many organizations. In fact, all organizations need to purchase something to exist. But we're saying now to be more effective, to be more competitive, we need to think in a process and a supply chain manner, looking at the different aspects of supply relationship management, strategic sourcing, and being able to not just buy, but buy competitively.
Right. So let's take it sequentially. That's kind of abstract. So
yes.
I know I looked at what Parker Hannifin does. I know you were working for a division called Raycor, and
yeah.
You know, so you do things like filters.
Okay. We do. We make diesel fuel filters.
Okay, great. So nothing could be less sexy than diesel fuel filters. But
absolutely.
Let's start at the beginning. You know, I keep hearing about, let's start with social responsibility.
Sure.
This is the Bay Area is very concerned about, they think corporations are, let's say, evil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what they really try to do is get into more responsible citizens. Does your role in sourcing, you know, we hear about, you know, sweatshops in Asia and all the rest mm-hmm. of it. And, you know, parts that are polluting. What does a supply chain manager do to ensure that Parker Hannifin is a good corporate citizen?
So it's an excellent question. It is a concern even outside of the Bay Area. Consumers, mm-hmm. manufacturers are all concerned about where their product comes from. And you can be concerned on a couple different levels. The continuity of supply level, making sure that you are getting what you're actually paying for, and also the social responsibility, the ethical level. So corporations, yes, we have that reputation of being evil, you know, big giants, sucking the life out of people and products. But really, it's unfounded in the fact that when you look at how organizations, big or small, look at sourcing, they've got to have make decisions, whether it be, this is the right product for me, this is the right source for me. Yes, there's government regulations that already tell you, don't get into relationships that are going to bring negative results to your organization from a social responsibility or even a profitability level. Poor social responsibility can lead to negative profits. So there's something in it for everybody.
So I want to work with that specific.
Sure.
So a filter.
Yes.
Right. What is the first socially responsible thing you do regarding getting that filter made?
So when looking at sourcing for a filter, the most unsexy product, as you mentioned, it is a bunch of paper, glue, metal, stuff like that. You think, oh, it's simple stuff to go source. Well, we're looking for something that is price competitive, but looking for supply chain partners that are going to stay with us over time. And that means that we want to make sure they're healthy organizations. We want to make sure that they're complying to laws and regulations that keep them in business for a long time, and that there isn't going to be a risk to our supply chain because they have a labor issue or because they've got a environmental spill issue. So we're concerned with how they run their business. Whereas old way of thinking and purchasing was, you handle your company, I'll handle my company, and we'll meet. So we're trying to be a little more seamless in our strategy approach.
Now, I had a guest on this show who's an expert on China.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have much manufacturing that goes on in China?
We have suppliers and source in China, yeah.
Okay. So he said that one of a common practice in China is to have something called the Golden Run, in which they recognize the American company needs to do the due diligence either because they're ethical or because they feel compelled to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they usually will not just do it on the phone or the internet, but they will actually send somebody to China. Yeah. Jeremy, if you think he's going to make too much noise, you can walk him around outside for a while if you want, whatever you want. Okay. So they American company will send somebody to China. And what will happen is the representative from this supplier in China will meet him and show him this beautiful factory with happy workers. You know, everything is wonderful. And in fact, and then maybe even the first run of filters comes from that company.
Mm-hmm.
But they know that the Americans don't want to spend the time and money to come back again. So after that first run, then they send it to this horrible factory in inland China with child labor, and they use inferior metals that will break down much faster, and they know you're not going to have the money to test that filter. What, if anything, does in real world, does a supply chain manager do to deal with that?
Well, there's various levels of sourcing. There's that initial reaction. Like you say, you're going to go out and meet with that company. You've seen their line card. You've gone, done your research online. You do need to go see them, whether they be in China or in the United States. It doesn't matter. And you get to know their organization as far as what is their strategy, who are they, and really go see what's going on. And it's not just that first run, because that is a worry. Even in domestic suppliers, that's a worry. Am I getting that first lot? Is that going to be the best lot I'm ever going to see? It's that continued sourcing development after the fact. It's the sourcing development of going back and visiting them at random or having policies and practices in place to where you can indicate if there's slippage before.
Do corporations, that sounds really expensive. Do corporations really do that ongoing diligence for quality control and send people out to the factories and check not only the first run or whatever?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Honestly, and they also spend time, what we call one of the newer fields in supply chain management, in which you see job postings all the time for things like supply chain analyst or supply chain sourcing manager. You're looking for people that are developing your supply base. It's not a set and forget type job. It is a go back, check, verify, improve. It is the improve aspect that is what makes it supply chain management and not just that transactional purchasing.
Tell me a real practical thing. You've been a supply chain manager for a while. When have you ever visited a factory and you've actually collaboratively with that supplier made an improvement in that company to both your company and their company's benefit?
Yes, that is one of our sourcing strategies through development, is to go back with key suppliers, especially that we are looking to eliminate waste in our processes, not only to reap the benefit on Parker's end, but also other suppliers' end. We'll do a 50-50 split if we need to. You know, say we're in this to help you make better products for us and source better and develop your product better for us so it integrates into our product line easily. If we can make a mutual benefit, let's both benefit profit-wise. So we've spent time eliminating risk with our supply base, sending teams in, saying, what is going wrong here that's providing product to us that isn't exactly
be
what
specific.
We want?
Can you give me one specific example of where there was something that wasn't efficient or effective or environmentally good that you guys fixed?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So we've gone on to... I worked with a supplier in the last 5 or 6 years. I want to be confidential with my company's information, but the same token, give you an example. Mm-hmm. We've gone back in and found that we weren't getting product delivered to us in the weekly buckets that we needed. We're like, why is this happening? We're continually having to expedite. We did is we went back into the suppliers and figured out they said they're going to stock for us. Well, it turns out they weren't stocking at all because we were moving our orders around and causing hectic mess with them. So we went back in with them and he said, let's start with how do you receive our purchase orders? We mapped the entire process out, went on their shop floor, saw how they were scheduling, provided a platform through a Kaizen event to show that we were looking to improve
Kaizen
their
process. Is the Toyota model originated
lean manufacturing
principle,
right, yes.
About being, just tell us quickly what Kaizen is.
So it is a rapid improvement event. That's exactly what it stands for, where you focus on what are you currently doing, what is the future state in which you want to improve to, and then you work in a short amount of time to get to that future state. And the key is not only making sure you get to that future state, but able to improve upon it from there and sustain it. So sustain it and then start all over again, looking for areas of rapid improvement.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. You're listening to the baby hour, where we intermittently hear babies scream and toddlers make noises and whatever.
Yes.
No, it's a family-friendly show. Here we are. It's a family-friendly station here at KLW, and I am talking with Celeste Ayers. She is a supply chain manager, and this is a really under-the-radar but good, interesting career. And so that's what we're talking about, and I encourage them to – they came all the way from Modesto. Mm-hmm. So I encourage her to bring her husband, Jeremy, who's got a great story to tell. And he will – you know what? I'm going to be in London. And their two kids, Adam and Alex, young kids. Jeremy, I feel like doing this. I don't know why. But you told me a very interesting story about your own career – after you, and I want to make sure, is this microphone going to work? Joanne, is that all right? We don't know. We'll try. After he got out of the military, and tell us what you did.
Well, I got out of the military and found myself really unemployed. But every time I went into the security industry and was told that I was overqualified from what I did in the military. So... but also being a disabled veteran, whenever I went before a job, I found myself still not getting hired. So after 13 years of working...
You said you were disabled but not still finding yourself hired. Explain that again.
After becoming disabled, when I got out, you had to do, well, in security or anything like that, law enforcement, it's physical.
Sure.
So if you put down
You're
a disabled veteran on the application, they start asking questions.
Sure.
Well, what is it?
Is it fair for me to ask you what your disability is?
It's knees and back.
Okay.
Continue.
Okay.
And so after that, I served about 5 years on a SWAT team and then just decided right after that to get into the executive protection field.
And what is that? That's bodyguard?
We use the term executive protection bodyguards, kind of like Kevin Costner.
Okay.
Everybody remembers Kevin Costner and the bodyguard with Whitney Houston.
Right.
But after that, I noticed trying to work on my education, went through the VA, used my benefits, and got the proverbial diploma on the wall, and thought then it was time to go and apply for jobs that would allow me to use the diploma, and I found myself back into the unemployment line.
What was your diploma, and where'd you get it, and how much did it cost you to get the degree?
University of Phoenix.
Okay, and how much did it cost you, and
the government spent $65,000 on a CJA program.
What CJA stands for?
Criminal justice.
Okay. And then, despite that degree, you said you were unemployed. How long were you unemployed after that?
Probably a good almost 3 years.
And then what?
And then, luckily, Alexander.
It's okay.
after about 3 years, I was fortunate enough to come into a company that asked me to take over, and it was a security group. And then I found out through the VA and different government programs of being disabled, minority-owned, American Indian-owned, there's certain programs that I could take advantage of. But even after jumping through all those hoops, at the end of the day, the government, there was no one on the other side. So from then, I made the decision with my partner at the time that we create a school. Okay. And it was a vocational trade school that would actually allow the student, veteran, or public for minimal amount of money to get started in a career. So right now we have the school, which teaches EMT, supply chain management, and executive protection.
Okay. And so this executive, my vision, my fear would be, you know, you hear about all these trade schools, and then everybody who graduates ends up having this, all this debt and not getting a job, or they're working as a security guard for $13 an hour.
Right.
What's the deal, really?
So the real deal is, after going through 4 years of regulatory, the Bureau of...
Meaning 4 years of regulatory, the government investigations.
Correct.
And checking. And right.
Exactly.
4 years.
4 years.
So how the hell are you expected to live when you got 4 years of government regulation before you can open your doors?
And this is the funny thing. The government doesn't tell you as a small business owner, you got to jump through all these hoops and you better hope you can survive. So literally, top ramen, you know, type of thing. And every dollar that you put goes into your business. There is... It's survival of the fittest.
Jesus. No wonder tuition is high.
Yes.
Okay, so now you finished the 4 years, and now you, so now you told me, I mean, I'm sure not all your graduates do this, but you said that you've got graduates from your bodyguard program, executive protection. What are they doing?
So, well, let me back up to one of the regulatory requirements is that we're held by the state to hold a certain employability rate. So we, whenever we get a student in, they pay their tuition, and after the program, they have to be employed.
Huh.
And not just to get employed for a month and then they drop off.
Not 100%. What percentage of your graduates have to be employed?
So right now, the state requires you to be almost 80%.
Wow.
Employability rate. So we have to train them, equip them, and then we put them out there. We have to actually make sure they're getting employed in the career field for which they spent their tuition.
Then why? I mean, you always hear about trade schools, you know, being these horrible places where they get all this money and then the people don't get jobs. What, you know, we all get our source, our information from the media. Are they wrong?
No, and I want to say, after going through this process, a lot of things changed because of the ITT fallout, the Hill College fallout, the government. From the Department of Ed, federal-wise, down to the state level, did change a lot of rules and regulations. But that's really still at the university degree-granting institution.
Mm.
So for a for-profit like mine that's a non-degree vocational school, we're actually held at a higher standard than your university.
Mm. Okay, so let's get to the punchline because I want to get back to
right.
Areas. Our main topic is supposed to be, what is it really like to be a supply chain manager? Tell me the punchline now about your business. It was really fascinating to me, which is why I brought you on.
Well, if you want a career in EMT or the first responder or executive protection, you come to my school, you go through it, and we'll help you get a job at the end of the day.
Oh, the punchline was Mark Zuckerberg. Tell the Mark Zuckerberg part.
Well, I can't disclose who our students graduate to, but they are major Silicon Valley executives,
oh.
And they are making between $60,000 and $100,000 in full benefits.
All right, Jeremy, your last name is Ayers too, I'm
yes.
saying. Yeah, Jeremy Ayers. Thanks for the for being a guest here, work with Marty Nemco. Okay, let's bring back Celeste in this nonlinear. Hopefully, the nonlinear approach is good for you. For those of you just joining us, the main purpose of this segment is to talk with Celeste Ayers about this under the radar career. I was shocked to find that there are 610 openings for supply chain managers. Most people think that supply chain managers, they don't know quite what it is. We're helping figure it out. And so, Celeste Ayers, welcome back.
Thank
now
you.
Now that you've played with your one-year-old.
I have. Thank you. And thank you for speaking to Jeremy. He's really in the supply chain of people.
Yeah, that's
I'm
true.
I'm in the supply chain of parts.
Okay. So we're walking through the process of fuel filter. We're talking about,
yeah.
You know, going and checking out the company and helping the companies that manufacture these things, that they're responsible and that their quality is good, not just the first run.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, now the thing is made. Supply chain manager's job is not done when the project is made. What's the next step? You've got this diesel fuel filter,
yep.
Right? And now what?
So we buy the components, bring them into the United States to manufacture our filters for distribution globally. So, yeah, I have a part. Great.
Why do you manufacture it here where they haven't manufactured in China where labor is cheaper?
You know, Parker does manufacture in China as well, but they have a multinational approach in their strategy to where the products manufactured in China are for Asian consumption, not for re-importation to the United States.
Why?
Since that's their global strategy that really benefits the localization of the economies there. So you can modify the same filter that's made in Modesto, California, is manufactured all over the globe, but is incrementally modified for those different business environments in those different parts of the world regionally. So it's really a neat concept, in my opinion. It's not just go into that country, sap up their resources of cheap labor or materials, and so on, bring them back to the United States for consumption. We have that mutual sharing of experience, you know, of making the same product globally, being able to refine it for regional consumption.
Okay, so it's been created.
It's a neat concept. Yep.
So we've got the product now. It was made in Modesto. Mm-hmm. What does the supply chain manager do next?
Well, we're constantly in this loop of making sure our customers are happy. You know, those are internal customers and external customers. My internal customers ultimately is operations, the team actually putting the filters together, the conversion of raw materials into a finished product. One filter isn't ever going to be enough. We've got to continue to fulfill that supply chain, that pipeline. So I'm going to be needing to buy more. I'm going to need to make sure that the sources are still viable. I need to make sure that the continuity of supply continues. And I've got to make sure that the ever-changing requirements of my customers, because my customers just don't make up their mind once and say, this is what I want. They're going to want to change that. That means changes are going to happen at my manufacturing level and with my supply base.
Do supply chain people make decisions about how much inventory, how much to order, you know, where to store it, working with your distributors to, you know, trucks, you know, are we going to fill this and whether does supply chain people do that?
Absolutely. That is one of the main core elements of supply chain is not just sourcing. Purchasing is one aspect of the supply chain, but it is the plan, make, source, deliver, and return. If you look at the EPIC score model, that is the definition of supply chain activities. So sourcing is one aspect, but the making, that conversion, the returning, and the sending around the world, the distribution and the inventory management side absolutely is part of the supply chain.
Well, what might surprise me about being in the whole field of supply chain management?
What is surprising to me is I didn't choose it. It came to me. And that's why I think a lot of people are starting to realize this is a viable choice. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, like there's 610 jobs just in the Bay Area.
Does that surprise you when I did that research and found that are there lots of jobs? What do you need to be viable? Do you need a college degree? And a degree in what? Do you need a real-world experience? Something you can, you know, as an entry-level job? Where are the good jobs, not crap jobs? There's always crap jobs in every field. Mm-hmm. Where is the entry point for good jobs in the world of supply chain?
There are entry points all over the supply chain because it's such a large breadth. You got from customer to supplier. Think of all the opportunities there, from customer relationship management to procurement to entry-level buying, assisting jobs, inventory management jobs, warehousing, logistics, transportation, a proliferation of opportunities, all falling under this title of supply chain management. It didn't surprise me to say there's 610 jobs with supply chain in the title or referenced. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In fact, APEX has done the research saying that, you know, there is an expectation of 10% growth incrementally over the next couple years in the supply chain management field, adding 270,000 jobs just in that supply chain realm.
Great. So if I'm listening to this, if I'm a listener to the show, I'm saying, okay, there's all this big supply chain all the way from manufacturer to the returns.
Absolutely.
Right. But I need, do I just start applying now? Do I go indeed in and apply? What's going to screen me? I don't want to be a truck driver necessarily. That's part of supply chain.
Definitely, it's part of a supply chain.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I don't want to be a truck driver. I want a white collarish job, paying a middle class living, where they're not going to send my job to India. What kind of training do I need? What kind of background do I need?
So, most job postings, you'll find a degree required. So now, universities such as Golden Gate, where I work, are looking for. They have degree paths that are operations and supply chain management. Absolutely, I'm going to advocate that. There's great growth, and then you learn the breadth and depth of a supply chain from a theoretical perspective. Work experience is great. anywhere where you can identify, hey, I've had suppliers, but it's usually required.
What if I'm like, most of the listeners to the show have a bachelor's in some liberal arts thing, women's studies, psychology,
okay.
You know, sociology.
Okay.
Are they dead? Can they get a job in supply chain?
Yes, they can. In fact, I have a buying position open right now in Modesto. And it is requiring a 4-year degree. I prefer business administration, so you have some understanding of how businesses work. I have people applying that are sociology majors.
Will they get hired?
They will get interviewed. And will I hire them? I hope so.
What's the kind of an interview question that you would ask? Let's say I'm a sociology major. Mm-hmm. That might help you assess whether you would actually hire me.
One of the key things in supply chain is being able to identify an issue, because something's breaking down in the flow of parts or communication or whatever. Being able to identify an issue and find the root cause and solve the problem.
So how would you ask that?
So I'd ask the question along those lines of, give me an example of a time where you encountered an issue. What was the problem and how did you approach that problem solving?
Well, I just graduated in sociology, and I certainly was given a lot of term papers where I had to organize my time and figure out, you know, where was a topic that was going to impress my professor and it wasn't going to bore me to tears. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I was going to discuss transgender sociological issues in San Francisco in terms of getting health care. And mm-hmm. So I then figured out that was the problem, and then I approached it by first starting on the internet and Googling, and then after a while I visited, there were some transgender support places, and I mm-hmm. did a number of interviews, and I merged my academic reading with my visiting, and I came with a report, and I got an A for the report.
That's a good start, and then I would follow up with something along the lines of, did you encounter any difficulties or failures in that research project? How did you tackle them?
Absolutely. They refused to see me at 3 places. They were busy. They said there were legal requirements. There was government, you know, there was confidentiality and HIPAA and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I managed to, you know, after 4 no's, I managed to get the 5th one to say yes, and as long as I kept it anonymous.
Sure.
Would I be hireable?
So it would be definitely a good start, and it would be a way that you are be able to articulate the issue, the systematic approach, but also being able to say the tenacity of being able to stop and go, I'm not getting the answer I want. I need to keep pushing forward. That's the hardest part in supply chain.
When we were waiting to come into the studio, you told me how onerous the government regulations are. Tell me about how government, for good, and I want to be balanced. What's good and what's bad about the government regulation that you say is a major part of your job?
So you have your own company has your own quality policies, right? Those are regulations that you internally keep your processes in balance and make sure you're doing what you're supposed to be due diligent about. But there are government regulations that interfere with business, such as the Frank Dodd Act that just came out with conflict minerals. That definitely impacts organizations where they have to declare, so organizations of certain size, and mine does comply to this, declare, are you buying gold, titanium, tungsten, tin from conflict areas, and are your suppliers buying from manufacturers and smelters and miners in these areas, and having to report that in? That's a whole layer of due diligence that wasn't there 4 years ago.
So, I mean, what countries are these? What are conflict areas?
So you're talking about the eastern the Congo area. I would have the list in my head because
But it's
seen
not just it's not part of like the 7 Muslim countries. It's not
at all.
Okay, and this is not a Trump thing, is it?
Definitely not a Trump.
Okay,
thing.
I just wanted to be sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure, but let me give our listeners an opportunity at least to call in and see if they've got a question for you.
Sure.
Can we take calls? Yeah, okay. So we're talking about this very under-the-radar field with lots of jobs called supply chain management, and there are opportunities everywhere from sourcing, finding the right sources of parts for your products, to all the way through delivery and importation and returns and delivery, you know, delivering via truck or whatever, intermodal transportation.
Everything.
Right, everything. If you've got a question about the world of being a supply chain manager, this is the time to call. The phone number here, Work With Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for the call to come in, if at all, I always like to do this with guests, especially if I like them. Every person has a career issue. and of their own. What is a career issue that you, Celeste Ayers, is facing right now in your career?
So where I'm at
Why don't you talk in the microphone real quickly?
Where I'm at right now in my own career development, you know, I've got my foot in industry. I really enjoy working with Parker Hannifin, and I've loved working there in the last 15 years. I really enjoy teaching as well. So where my dilemma really lies is what next in my career development? Am I going to move on to a different role within purchasing? Do I want to go back into trade compliance on the importation, exportation of goods? Do I want to go more into more of a role of logistics management, all of which I've done at some level? I enjoy them equally. The other dilemma is, do I step out of industry completely and go completely academic and work at the university through the university systems? Or that third option, which I toy with as well, is, you know, going into the education field like my husband has done with his trade school and going through the APICS arm, where I'm heavily involved in going through the instruction of certifying adults for supply chain management, which is that gap, that skill gap we're so desperately encountering in the supply chain management area.
Watching your face as you're talking and also listening, I'm just trusting my intuition here. The deep down, you would like to go into the education part of it. Is that correct?
I do love the education part of it deep down, but I also have this nagging thing right now that my best professors are ones that were doing.
Exactly.
And I'm afraid of stepping out of industry.
Right.
And losing that edge.
So why wouldn't you either? Now, how much do you care about leadership? You know, the American thing, way is up is the way. How much do you care? Let's assume that you're going to spend at least part-time, maybe even full-time, in your job at Parker, or you're going to end part-time doing teaching, which is kind of what you're doing now.
Yes.
Would you want to rise upward to a higher level of management? Are you happy with your current level of management? Do you want to become a specialist in one area? Do you want to take a step down and be an individual contributor? What would the goddess within you, the wise woman within you, tell you you should do?
So where I'm called to right now is to really develop the team I have. That is my leadership focus. I am not hell-bent on being in the C-suite at all. Titles mean absolutely nothing to me. I am in the realm of human development in supply chain specialty. So right now I'm in charge of a tactical buying team in Modesto and another one in another state. And my job right now, what I love, what keeps me going and keeps my foot in industry, the challenges of bringing the team to the level they need to be competitive on the global market and really seeing that human resource side of supply chain development.
Normally, I'm always asking for proactive behavior, but from what I'm hearing, you don't need to change. You are teaching part-time.
Mm-hmm.
You are doing what you love, and you're getting a chance to do it at a Fortune 250 company, so which generally tends to treat their workers better than small companies because they have the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What if I said you don't need to do anything right now, and you also want to get two young children?
Yes, I do.
So what if I say for now, just stay the course, and there will be a side path that is yet not determined that will make itself apparent, especially since you're so involved in APICS, the professional association. Stay involved in that, and you never know what opportunities will come. Does that feel right, or am I missing something?
That is where I'm called to be right now. That's where I'm heading, and I'm going to put all my energy into it until that another door opens where I know I need to deviate from this path. So I'm very happy where I am. There are challenges, but I'm happy where I am.
Let's take one
Thank
call. Let's see.
Sure.
Yeah. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Celeste Ayers, who is a manager in supply chain, a great growing field. What is your question for her?
Question. How is this different from just purchasing? I've worked for the state a series of contract jobs for a number of years, buying everything from medical goods and pharmaceuticals to facilities, HVAC kind of heavy equipment, basically
mm-hmm.
stuff that costs under $50,000 a pop.
Mm-hmm.
So how is supply chain management different from this kind of purchasing? I'm kind of a gear person. I understand technology needs, you know, as far as features and benefits and all that. And I'm a good negotiator on price, but where does this purchasing fit into that supply chain picture?
So excellent question, and I do get that quite often, is how is purchasing different supply chain? Purchasing is part of the supply chain, but when we look at purchasing as a discipline or procurement as a discipline within a supply chain, you have that sourcing and acquisition side, but then you have to think about beyond the contract, how do we keep the relationship moving forward? How do we keep the companies integrating? And that is the ultimate goal in supply chain management, is integrating your supply base into your organization to a point where there isn't a line between the two organizations.
Well, so, this sounds like the the Japanese companies like Toyota, who would say, go to a manufacturer and say, you make the seats for us and only for us, and you produce them just in time as we need them.
That is a concept of supply chain management. That is lean manufacturing 101, the Toyota way, that where they did go in and develop the relationship with the suppliers by owning a majority of the business as well and dedicating their footprint in that organization. The challenge with supply chain management is we don't have that authority and that strategy to go into those supply base. So how do you influence them, and your supplier, to work with you, to develop with you, and how to eliminate cost in your processes that you can share in the cost reduction and the benefits of growth of both organizations? How do you mitigate the risk of supply? How do you work through the troubling times of when there's a supply constraint for raw material? How do you work together and share information? It's no longer you get a contract, fulfill that contract. It's how do we get to the end goal of satisfying my customer together?
I want to thank you very much for the call. Every guest who I've ever had normally says, oh, I wish I would have said that. So I'd like to give you one more. What if there was one more thing you'd like to tell our listeners about careers in supply chain management, what would it be?
So one thing I must leave you with, it's an excellent question. What's the difference? If you're curious, what is supply chain management? What does it mean? The place to go is APEX. APEX.org. Research it. They will tell you exactly what you need to know, what careers are out there.
That's APICS.org.
That is correct.
And Celeste Ayres, thank you for bringing your children and yourself and your husband to work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks for having us. It's a wonderful day. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Enjoy your day in San Francisco. Before you go back to Modesto, you can live in Modesto forever. You're not in San Francisco that often.
That's very true.
Go do something fun.
We will. Thank you.
All right. All right, dear listeners, now I want to have fun with you, or at least help you. So if you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I can usually help. I do what are called workovers, no pummeling involved. Usually, occasionally, it depends on you. You'll get a straight answer. I will try to help you with your work problem. You're 16 or 76, unemployed, well-employed, for-profit, non-profit, government. The phone number here for a workover, the price is certainly right, zero, zippo, nada, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And does it look? It looks like I've got a call on the line already. Yeah, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's your question? How can I help you? Are you there? I guess you're not there. Okay. So, again, phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay, while we're waiting for the calls to come in, I tweet. I love tweeting because it forces me to distill my best arguments into 140 characters or less. And that works very well for radio as well. So here are some of my tweets that I've written recently that hopefully will be of value to you. So, be kind, tough, or avoidant as appropriate. So again, think cosmically and ask yourself in each interaction, is it wiser to be kind, tough, or to avoid the issue? Most people tend to default to one, and they're all right in the right situation. So it's nice to have that little template in your mind. In this situation, with this person and these time constraints and the importance thereof, would it be wise to be kind to the person, tough with the person, or simply avoid it? Just don't, sometimes, the old cliche, let sleeping dogs lie. Sometimes it's worse to bring it up. Next tip, next tweet is career related. I can't stress, and this is very indirectly related, but it really is remarkably potent. I can't stress enough the power of music to uplift. It's hard to be depressed or annoyed at work when you're listening to your favorite pump it up or calm you down music. Next one. This came from the Guardian, and I have a link to it here. Rising deaths among white middle-aged Americans could exceed the AIDS toll in the U.S. And if we all know that work is a major source of stress and in turn disease. Be careful. Next. I did a career workshop at a low-performing high school. It was in Oakland. It was near my house. I was asked to do it and happy to do it as part of my pro bono work. It was scary how many kids aspired to be musicians, fashion designers, etc. I don't, you know, just expanding on that. There is such a belief that people in these cool careers are happier. And yet, I have found again and again, and my previous guest, who is in this absolutely not sexy career, supply chain management, and her job is to ensure quality supply chain for filters, diesel filters. And she and many people in those under-the-radar fields are happier because they have to pay good money to get somebody because it's not sexy. Whereas if you're in one of those cool, you're in fashion or in entertainment or in sports, there's 10 zillion people wanting to do it, and only the very top few, the Beyoncés, get the 50 million. As I had said in an earlier show, Pepsi paid Beyoncé $90 million to flog Pepsi, that sugary drink, to the very people she claims to care about. But there are very few Beyoncés, and there's 10 zillion wannabes who are, you know, not making a living. And it was depressing to me, and frankly, a lot of the students, they were not even able to articulate a sentence in decent grammar. And they aspire to these big, big careers. I wish we did a better job of being more honest in telling students what are options, both that are A, realistic, and B, probably as or more likely to generate a reasonable income, job security, etc. All right, let's go to the phones. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello, this is Micah speaking.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I hear you beautifully.
Yes, perfect. I might have a very, very general question, but let me tell you something about my professional history. I was trained as a medical doctor in Germany. Mm-hmm. I have specialized in ears, nose, and throat.
Mm-hmm.
And I have worked in as a basic researcher in auditory neuroscience over the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So starting in 1995, I was working at UCSF here in the United States for 10 years, and the past 10 years I've worked in research in Germany, where I have my own lab and where I have a permanent position.
Mm.
So my goal now, my entire job experience has been in academics,
mm-hmm.
so my goal now is to return to the United States, preferably to the Bay Area, because my husband lives here and he's American. I also have a green card. So
mm-hmm.
I would like to have, I think, input from your side, because, like I said, I might be very naive because my main experience was in academics. But what possibilities you see for somebody like me to look for positions in the Bay Area here in the United States.
Now, first question, do you want to stay in the research area? And if so, what is your expertise, or do you want to get out of research into something else?
I think it's twofold. So I know it is very, very difficult in a specialized field like the one that I'm working in to find a position at a university in the United States, of course. So I would love to stay in research. However, I would also be open to work in a related field. I mean, of course, my first goal would be to stay in the academic world, to work at a university. work in research, but I would also be open to work in related fields.
How was your experience? What did you do at UCSF, and what was your, you know, how were you perceived there, and is there a reason you wouldn't make that your first stop?
Well, I was working there, the postdoc, and later on I was employed as a researcher, and so I did basic neuroscience work. And but it is very difficult, of course, to find an academic position in the United States to get back into the research business.
To be a PI, for sure, but, you know, UCSF is one of the best-funded universities in the world for research. Now, tell me a little, at the risk of getting into the weeds, was your ENT as an interface, obviously, with neuroscience, with brain science, what is your expertise? Are you an instrumentation person? Are you a, you know, are you more of a chemist person? Tell me about your areas of expertise, both in terms of domain as well as technical expertise.
So my interests are work on the effects of deafness and hearing loss on signal processing in the auditory system. And my main background is that I do electrophysiological studies in models of deafness. So I'm recording, more or less from the brain, how neurons process.
Now, deafness is not, you know, these days there are certain topics that are very hot, and deafness is not particularly one of them, to my knowledge. But there, by being an expert in the measurement of deafness and again the signal processing to the brain, there are obviously companies that are developing everything from hearing aids to hearing loss prevention or cure of different kind, you know, not beyond hearing aids, surgical techniques, etc.
My field also on cochlear implant research.
Yeah, exactly, right. So there's all kinds of, you know, devices are where the money is, for better or worse. But certainly there are a lot of companies that are involved in, you know, in all aspects of hearing loss, addressing hearing loss. Have you, and should you be systematic about making a list of the companies that are doing that kind of research and seeing if you could get a job working for them? Have you done that?
I know about a few companies. That's true. I haven't approached them yet. I think because in the back of my head, I was still hoping to get back into the university environment.
So the smart idea really there is you have nothing to lose by going both ways.
Yeah.
You know, you find the institutions that have big grants regarding sensory loss. Whether it be at UCSF or Stanford or Berkeley, obviously in the Bay Area, those are the places that have the grants, or Kaiser Permanente may have grants as well. Go there first, and either simultaneously, or if that doesn't work, then you make a list of the companies that are based in the Bay Area that are doing work, on auditory loss. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, yes.
Well,
yeah.
Then I'll quit while I'm ahead, and I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Anyway, whatever your work-related problem is, I can usually help. You certainly don't need a PhD to have a PhD problem. I've helped people who are truck drivers. So whatever your station in life, as the KLW slogan used to be, the phone number here for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. In between calls, what I've been doing is I've been sharing tweets that I've written that are career related. I do love tweeting, as I said, because it forces you to essentialize your main points in a short enough format that people will actually use it. You know, too often academics tend to feel like they want to cover their butts, and so they go at great length, they write monographs and books. In the end, I wonder sometimes whether these very brief bits of advice, if they're useful, end up making more of a difference in people's lives. So here is a tweet. Bosses often don't criticize to avoid demotivating their worker and to avoid defensiveness on the part of the worker. They also withhold praise for fear it'll cause complacency or demands. So the result, of course, is that the workers end up with very little feedback. And so, you know, certainly best advice is to be giving ongoing, tactfully dispensed feedback. And yes, and that includes praise, because it's not, yes, it is true, if you praise a lot, it's going to it can easily cause make somebody complacent or ask for a raise or whatever. But you're not just about the bottom line. You're a human being. And people crave praise as long as you give it when it's earned. And in terms of criticism, your job as a boss is to give negative feedback where necessary, but the nuance and the art is in doing it in a way that is not demotivating. And that can be as simple as these, you know, kind of cliche tactic of using the sandwich. You start by saying something positive about the person, then tactfully suggesting this criticism, and then end with something positive. Or it simply could be to simply say, I've noticed this, and here are some examples. Am I missing something? So you're opening the door for the person to respond, and so you're not just slamming it down their throat. But it's certainly, you know, one of my most, the interviews that I've ever done on this show that I felt good about was with Jack Welch, the legendary CEO of GE, and I asked him, you know, you're called Neutron Jack because you got rid of a lot of people. And I said, how does that make you feel? I said, how does it make you feel? And he says, I'm actually proud of it. Because at GE, everybody knew where they stood. And by knowing exactly where they needed to improve or whatever, they were more likely to improve. And if in really I got rid of some people, it's really does a great service to the remaining workers who want to work with good workers and not saddled by poor workers. And it's good for the shareholders, the teachers and social workers and psychologists who've invested their money in mutual funds, hoping to save for college or retirement. And it ultimately serves the consumer because if we have A-player employees, then the refrigerators, which were at the bottom of Consumer Reports rankings when I first took over, and then by the time I left, it was at the top. Everybody who ever buys a refrigerator or sits in an airplane with, because many airplanes are run by GE engines, they can count on a quality product. So your obligation really is not to be, as the previous guest was saying, not a soul sucker, a corporate soul sucking person, but to bring out the best in each person. And if that person really isn't, this place of work is not the right place for you, for that person, the ethical thing to do is to gently counsel them out. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
This will take about a half a heartbeat. We just happened coincidentally to be speaking with somebody recently who was and had a similar skill set to the caller that you just spoke to. Hmm. And she was actually heading to an interview with a Dolby company. So we passed that along because it might be useful for the caller.
It's possible. It seems a little, it's very, very applied. For those of you just joining us, the previous caller was a PhD with a special in academic research in the area of hearing loss and nerve conduction. It seems a little bit distal, a little far afield to think that Dolby would hire her. They would be much more likely to hire a PhD in acoustics or whatever. But I certainly appreciate the generosity of your spirit in picking up the phone. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. What's your question? How can I be of help to you?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if you can give me some advice on how to find a career counselor with very deep technical knowledge.
Most career counselors don't have very deep technical knowledge.
Yeah.
Tell me more about your situation. Let me see if I can help you for free. Price is right here. So tell me about what your situation is.
I have a PhD in computer science.
Okay.
But I don't have a long publication record or anything like that. I'm 50.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend said, "Well, go out and get a job as a coder." That's what I went to grad school to escape from.
Right.
You know? And so, yeah, I'm thinking maybe there's some better coding jobs out there. Maybe I should learn a different type of thing. Maybe I should be looking at one sort of company or another sort because, you know, I'm not really much enjoying the job I've got now.
You wanted to escape from coding. When you first went into, you know, to get a PhD, which is obviously a major commitment, what was the vision at that point?
A certain type of, you know, there's a certain area. Why did I go to the grad school?
Yeah, you were sick of coding. You didn't want to code, so you saw the PhD as an escape from coding. What was the vision you had at that point? Oh. What did you see yourself doing after the PhD?
I wanted to be an industrial researcher. I thought academia would be too hard for me.
Okay.
but in industry, and I was able to get a job. It wasn't a great job doing that kind of thing, but it was in that area for a while.
What kind of industrial research right now, if you were to go back there versus, say, you know, when I think of a PhD in CS, you're going to be able to program in assembly language. You're not going to be needing to use a higher level language like Ruby on Rails or something.
Well, I was using, I mean, I'm doing Android right now.
Okay.
I have C++. I have a little embedded background.
Most people who are 50.
That's not really the area I want to.
I got it.
You know, the area I want to work on is the intelligent user interfaces.
Oh, I see. Now,
yeah.
How? I don't normally think of a PhD in computer science being much related to interface design. Do you have real expertise in interface design, or if that's what you really want to do, do you need another credential or more training of some sort?
Well, the problem is that, you know, when you hear interface design, you're thinking of laying out the buttons and the widgets and things like that. You know, I was doing a system that, you know, like things like Siri. That's uh-huh. the area that interests me.
So is it the interface with Siri, or is it the algorithms for determining, you know, the voice, you know, how to help, for example, Siri determine one voice from another? It's got to interpret thousands of different kind of human voices.
No, not that. No, how it thinks inside, and you know, it's a form of interaction. The way it responds, it doesn't necessarily. I don't care what color the button is or something like
of
that.
Of course.
The sort of the back end semantics, and it can apply to regular GUI applications, but I'm not choosing colors or proportions or things like that. I'm choosing trying to design the lower level or the, mm-hmm. the lower level, the
I know
higher
what you
level
mean.
Things, the things that the sort of the logic of it, that it is both algorithm and something that the user's mental model of how things work.
Okay, so really is very foundational algorithm development, real good flowchart development, that kind of stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I mean with the human in mind.
Right.
You know, the sort of the algorithm that interacts with the human, not the algorithm that just does what it needs to do, but the algorithm that is the I don't know. You know, the way you think about the application.
Right. And how much are you interested in that voice interface? Is that a big deal? I'm trying to focus.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, well, that's what I am passionate about. I don't do the recognition
okay.
part of it though.
So
not,
when I just think
I
I'm looking at the clock, I'm going to have to stop pretty soon. But what jumps
okay.
out to mind for me is certainly voice recognition is critical in a number of areas. Number one, for the disabled, for people who need to use voice commands and can't use keyboards. I think
yeah.
about Google doing Google automatic translation, because mm-hmm. right now they've got text translation, but I'm sure they're very involved in verbal voice translation. Obviously, or any kind of artificial, somebody who's busy, right now Amazon has a new product called Echo, which is voice recognition based, kind of a human, like a robotic servant for people at home.
Oh yeah, I know what these things are. I know what these
Well, I'm helping my listeners.
I'm interviewing them.
Right.
In fact, but,
so what if I yeah. said that what you need to do in order to get hired in that is to, if you already don't have it, have a work sample of the kind of model, whether it be the flowchart, whether it be an algorithm, whether it be a piece of code that translates the algorithm, and that you
yeah.
need to send those samples to the director of research for those kind of projects, and you need to be focused enough. You can't count out one or two or three. You're 50. You're kind of a relative, ironically, a newbie at it. So you need a relatively
yeah.
large number of companies, first, second, and third tier, who are working on this kind of stuff, and use that job sample rather than your resume as a way to get hired. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I have a video I made of an interaction of that sort. I mean, it's sort of hard to describe these things verbally. So
okay, so video is fine or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's my best shot, is to get narrow focused. I don't think you can be all over the map. I have to say
okay.
goodbye.
You don't think I can find a good career counselor who would know
more than that? I don't think so. I think I've given you about as much as most career counselors could on the tech. I decided to stay very technical with you. I think that's my best shot. I don't know how I would do it. I might go look at, you know, maybe at the Stanford Career Center or whatever like that, and see if they've got somebody, but that's the best I've got.
Okay, well, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. Okay, that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I'll do workovers on callers and careers in another not-sexy field, but it's really kind of cool, packaging. Sue Selke, director of Michigan State University, a very prestigious program, their School of Packaging. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.